Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast from British International Investment, where we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it's transforming global business. In today's episode, we're discussing how we can close gender gaps and support women's economic participation. Now, worldwide, gender inequality is deeply ingrained in systems and institutions, and women's economic participation is limited by the discrimination and unequal opportunities they face. And despite progress, the world isn't on track to achieve gender equality by 2030. At BII, we're committed to making our investments work for women. And in 2018, we launched our gender finance strategy. Our aim was to support companies in becoming more diverse with more women leaders and more high-quality jobs and products that meet women's needs. Just over 6 years later, and we've taken stock of our progress and what we're learning, and we've shared these findings in a report which you can find on our website. Now, at the end of 2024, we hosted an event to delve deeper into some of the themes in the report and ask how we can best support businesses in further advancing gender equality. Two exceptional founders joined us on the panel for the event. Roshane Zafar from Cash Foundation, a women-focused microfinance business based in Pakistan, and Kachi Izakane from Trade Depot, a company in Nigeria that connects informal retailers, most of whom are women, to goods and financial services. Also on the panel was Maria Smith, the Chief Impact Officer at British International Investment. And the conversation was chaired by Sarah Champion MP, a leading women's rights advocate and chair of the UK Parliament's International Development Committee. And it's with Sarah that we begin this episode.
I'm here today to introduce to all of you three inspiring people who have actually used their own power to share and empower others around the world. From talking to them before we came into the room, this is something that they have clearly dedicated their lives to, and I thank you for doing that. And we need more people like you. Roshane, could you tell us a little bit about your foundation?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah, for what you were saying. I'm going to give you the elevator speech because this is a 30-year trek or journey that I want to share with you. So I'm an economist by training, and I used to work for the World Bank, and a lot of my job was to go and talk to women across Pakistan, hearing their stories. And women would look at me and say, well, you may be different, you may be educated, you may have seen the world, but you know, actually our aspirations are very similar. We desire a better life for ourselves and our families, but we don't have the economic wherewithal to influence that change. So the notion of economic agency is what brought me into microfinance. And in this initial questioning, I met Dr. Yunus of the Grameen Bank, and he really inspired me with his story of how Grameen started with a small group of women, giving them loans to start businesses. So we started with 15 women in 1996, and I worked as a loan officer in the community. And today we've helped over 7.5 million women set up micro businesses, and 100% of them have paid us back in spite of whatever's going on in the country. So I think we need to recognize the power of women's economy.
One of the allegations against women in business is that they're great at microfinance, but they can't scale their businesses up.
Interesting question.
So is that something that you have seen? Have you seen, I mean, maybe not the original 15 women, but have you seen women who are able to become bigger employers?
Okay. So that's an extremely good question because, so there'll be what I call, if you look at women in the low-income community as entrepreneurs, there are two kinds of entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs by choice, women who have chosen to set up businesses, and entrepreneurs by circumstances. So for example, the husband falls sick and nobody can earn, so she goes into the business and starts running it. So you will see two kinds of, I mean, to be very crude in terms of determining entrepreneurship. So from that level, there is the inclination to grow their business, and what I was actually discussing earlier also, that there's a research that we've just done to see risk averseness or risk-taking habits within entrepreneurs as they start taking larger loans. So what we see is that women tend to hold their cards very close to their chest. And they tend, as they grow their businesses, they feel that they have more to lose. So they're less likely to take those risks that they took earlier on in the life of the relationship. And that is one of the reasons what prevents them from growing their businesses. But on the other side, we also have to alleviate all the barriers that I mentioned in the beginning. So where you are alleviating those barriers, you do see the uptake on women growing their businesses much more. organically, what data tells us, and this is World Bank data that I'm quoting, it's about 5 to 10% women graduating to the other level. But if you slice and dice the data further, as I was mentioning to you, how many women businesses are creating jobs, we do see 25% of them creating jobs. So if that is our criteria of saying that is the criteria we're using for business growth, then 25% would be actually growing. But if our criteria is revenues and sales, then maybe the number would be 5 to 10%.
Roshane underlines the importance of access to finance in enabling women to grow their businesses. And a company doing just that is Trade Depot. Based in Nigeria, Trade Depot enables informal retailers, most of whom are women, to access the credit they need. Kachi Izukane is the company's co-founder and CEO.
I'm based out of Lagos in Nigeria. If you walk into any city in Lagos, let's say you want to buy a tin of milk, you walk to a retailer down the street from you, 8 times out of 10, it's a woman-owned business, right? And when she bought that tin of milk, the party she bought it from, six and a half times out of 10, is also a woman-owned wholesaler, right? So this ecosystem essentially is run by women. But when we did a check and looked at access to financing, right? If you were, more than half of the retailers that were getting access to financing were male-owned businesses, right? So there was already an imbalance there that you had to solve for. Some of these imbalances come from the way traditional financing has been set up. The expectations that this is built off of collateral that you have, like these are things which already eliminate the bulk of this audience. So what we've tried to do is, first of all, figure out how to simplify access for these parties. And this has been everything from providing tech tools, not just mobile apps, but even tools that they use like WhatsApp, allow them to use these same tools to get access to the inventory, but very importantly, understand in their territories what makes the most sense to stock, right? Which products am I going to be able to sell off quickly if I get them? And then we try to focus our decisioning for who should get credit on their transaction histories so that there's no bias in any way, but we're actually giving you or getting you access to financing because you're able to, deploy it. And so what we then see is more and more of these businesses who are able, because they have access to finance, to buy more volumes, which means also better discounts. And there's this
A positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
So then on the ground for that little shopkeeper, what's the difference that they've seen?
We had one lady, for instance, who we were engaging with. We actually were on a visit. And she was pointing out that she wasn't stocking flour previously, right? It wasn't something she was familiar with. But getting that insight that, look, it makes sense for you to stock this, and then getting the capital to do so suddenly means that she has a new line of business that's earning her 9% monthly margins.
Wow.
You know, and this was a business she wasn't doing before with capital she didn't have before. So for them, the impact is actually immediate. Because in 2 months, she already has a line of business that is growing, you know, and they suddenly feel empowered. I think to really appreciate this, you need to think about how these retailers see the world. The way they see it is, my circumstances are my circumstances and nobody's coming to save me, right? So it's what it is. What I can do is what I can do. Like, I'm pretty much capped by this already. So for them, it's not so much the additional capabilities they get, but that realization that, you know what, I don't necessarily need to have this cap. There's probably so much more that I can apply myself to get done.
Trade Depot and Cash are companies we've invested in as part of our work to support women's economic empowerment. They both show how we back businesses that improve access to finance for women. Though we should say that our approach is broader than this and includes firms from different sectors where women are well represented as leaders, employees, and customers. The approach we've taken to closing gender gaps has developed over time. And our third panelist, our Chief Impact Officer Maria Smith, shared more about that evolution.
We've been on a journey, so it's been an evolution, and I think we're able to direct it more and more as we go. But to your question, you know, how do we ensure that we are really channeling capital to the women that we need, that need it? How do we make sure that there is outcomes that we want to see from that? How does that happen across the board? So at the, you know, we look at it from a board perspective, from an ownership perspective, from a customer. So for example, in financial services, we use directed lending lines to ensure that our money is going to women-owned businesses, and we track what kind of businesses are there, what size of loans are we offering, you know, how is that changing over time? Are they getting, you know, larger amounts as they go? Additionally, you know, we're thinking about the ecosystem, and we talked a lot about this, but it's not just about jobs, women jobs, it's what's the quality of those jobs? How are we protecting them from with HR policies returning to work, how are we protecting them against gender-based violence? And so we've been spending a lot of time thinking about not just job numbers, which is, you know, important, but what kind of jobs are they? Are they in low-income countries? So we've been trying to push into lower-income both countries, but also populations in terms of our gender reach. And, you know, we do see a strong correlation with, you know, we have a decent size in our portfolio now in low income segments, but there's a very high correlation with the percentage that are of women. So, I mean, it's an evolution. We can always do better, but we really are trying to have more scrutiny about where the funding goes.
And both of our panelists spoke about talking to the people, finding, you know, what the gaps were, what the blocks were, what the support could be. How important is that when it comes to BII investing in a business, actually knowing that it's come from the grassroots or the ground up?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we have an increasing focus on stakeholder voice, right? So we do that before we invest through surveys. We do it through, working with businesses, sometimes through technical assistance to really understand what the customer or the employee needs are. And then we try to use that to basically come up with the components of any gender action plan. And over time, we're trying to do more and more stakeholder outcome measurement as well. So that in holding ourselves accountable that what we said on the tin we're doing as the investment progresses.
Picking up on this point of how best to measure impact, Roshana Zafar discussed the approach Cash Foundation takes.
When we look at impact at the level of the client that we are trying to service, what is it that we want to see? So the economic impact is always easy. The evidence of the economic change is always easy to evaluate, whether it's returns in business, whether it's savings, whether it's profitability. But it's the social impact that needs to be really looked at. So in our case, we just don't look at the economic change. We also look at the social change. So for example, one of the criticisms of microfinance that we've heard is that domestic violence will go up as a result of the loan because the men would want to, you know, take control both of the income or the loan itself. So in our case, when we went out there to look at social impact, we added domestic violence as an indicator to see whether that was changing, whether it was increasing. The second thing we looked at was the relationship between the spouses, the interspousal relationship in terms of decision-making. How did that change? The third factor we look at is how it's not just about decision-making, but it's about the ability to influence that change. So we also looked at that, for example, age at marriage of girls. Mm. In Pakistan today, unfortunately, 30% of young girls get married before 15 years of age. And that perpetuates the cycle of poverty for them in many ways. So we measure all those things to see whether through these loans, are women able to influence these decisions, even sending a girl to school, for example. So what we saw, I'll just give you the example of domestic violence. What we saw on domestic violence is over the years, and we mapped this. And one of the things I've also learned is if you're working with women, you have to be evidence-backed. You have to have a hard nose about it. Because if you're not able to show the results, you won't be able to move the needle, as Kashi was saying. So we looked at that factor, and we saw that in 40% of the cases where women were running their own businesses, domestic violence actually went down as a result. Because we further looked at it, and we talked to the men and the women, they said to us, because most domestic fights start over money. So once the woman is earning, she's less likely to depend on the husband or be asking or nagging him, so to speak, to get the money. So we measure impact both on the economic and the social aspect.
The The report underlines how closing gender gaps is not just the right thing to do, it also creates economic opportunities. This is echoed by Trade Depot's experiences.
Obviously, economically, we see the benefits. But also, something that is easy to lose sight of is how interconnected it all is, right? When you're thinking of the ecosystem of economic empowerment, it's really quite interconnected. And I think a story that really exemplifies this beautifully is we have a partner called Camco Foods. They are the third largest confectionery manufacturer in India, right? We've been working with them for a while. Their products sell off the shelves really quickly in Nigeria. And then we've gone into a partnership to sort of be their exclusive partners across the continent. And so we spent time at their facilities in Indore in India. And then you find out that about 80% of their production workforce are women. So we help them with access to market. And then it helps them, you know, build a bigger business, reinvest in these women, and it's a powerful cycle, right? You realize that you're driving real impact at scales that you take for granted at first, right? That there's a ripple effect that is cross-border that comes out of what you're doing. The fact that you recognize that getting up in the morning, spending time brainstorming, going out to do something actually moves the needle, and not just in Lagos or Ibadan, but as far away as Indo, which is, you know, like leagues away, it really does get not just myself, but it keeps the team popped up, and it really keeps us going. So it is quite fulfilling in that regard as well.
Meanwhile, Roshane says that getting the maximum benefit from taking a gender-smart approach means looking at every level of the business, from the customer right through to the boardroom.
There's a step up, which is also in the report, which is the institution. What is it doing about gender within its own DNA? So I'll share a very interesting story regarding that. When we started Kashf, our mantra was microfinance for women by women. And that was it. We never hired men. So till 10 years into our organization, we only hired women who used to work for women, because the idea was that women are best, and it goes back to Kashi's comment, women are best serving other women. Because it'll be very difficult for a woman in our community to actually speak to another male in terms of accessing the service. But I remember I was at a conference in one of the local business schools, and a young man stood up and said, but then you are perpetuating gender discrimination as well. This was his question to me. And I suddenly realized, yes, gender equity is everybody's problem. It's not just a woman's problem. It's a men's problem. It's a social problem. So then we started getting the men in. When that happened, we had to come up with matrices to actually determine gender equality within the organization. So we started gender sensitization trainings. We looked at sexual harassment at the workplace. So, you know, you have to do all of this to exercise, or rather push the envelope for women. So it just doesn't stop at the client level. If you're really talking about closing the gender gap, it has to be at every little level, and then at the board. So, you know, 70% of Kashf's board is women, and they keep asking all these questions all the time to us, and why are we doing this? What impact will it have at the end of the day? So I think it has to go at every level.
As the main discussion drew to a close and we opened the floor to questions, attentions turned to the future, and one audience member asked how women can be supported to develop digital businesses.
There's a few things that seem obvious at first, but one thing I think we've found is you need to figure out how to make the technology a part of their lifestyle, right? It needs to be that, you know, as people, we are using technology in different ways. How can this same tech that we are familiar with be used to help drive the things we do? Else you will be left with an adoption problem, right? And so there's a ton of apps out there that you help a lot of people do so many different things. But what you will tend to find is those apps don't get used as much as, you know, it doesn't really deliver the transformation it promises, right? And so if there's something we spend a lot of time doing, it's trying to figure out, for me, what will my mother use, right? Now, she runs a small store in Enugu in Nigeria. She's in her 70s. You know, when we were growing up, she was our model for tech, because she would be the one to put the video on and so on. But in real terms, you know, tech is not her native space. And so if you're trying to make her business better and I tell her, look, you need to get this, get on this system, learn how to do this, it's not really going to happen, right? So building those tools that are embedded into things they use. WhatsApp is a good example. Like everybody is used to sending messages on WhatsApp. And you give them an experience that is similar to that. Can them getting insights about what products to stock or look at their wallet or other product be as simple for them as sending a message to someone?
When COVID happened, we introduced a training program called Not Letting COVID Happen to My Business. And in that, we then went in and taught women how to use WhatsApp for business, Facebook for business. And that was our first venture into digital literacy training for women. We've continued to do that. And only last week, I was in a community, in a remote community in Pakistan, where one of our clients was running a jewelry business. And I asked her, you know, how, that's a standard question, how has life changed for you? What did Kush do for you? What were some of the benefits? And she recalled that 3 years ago, she had attended this Not Letting COVID Happen to Her Business training. And in that, she had learned how to use WhatsApp. So I said, all right, are you still using it? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, what difference did it make? And she said to me that where her she was selling, let's say, one jewelry item that she's making a day, that has now amplified to about 30 items, and they're going all over the country. So sitting in her little remote community, working, making these beautiful jewelry pieces, she was now getting them across. So that's the impact that you can see through, as I was mentioning, through digital. Now, the downside of this is for women is that even if Pakistan has 80% penetration in telephony, women don't have control over it. So in every house, in every low-income house, you will have a phone, but it doesn't necessarily belong to the women. And that's where the problem lies, and that's what we have to overcome, and that's the challenge. You can train women to use it, you can see the impact, but the user case is where we are stuck, and that's the next, I guess, next big thing that we have to consider.
I think what I've learned most from listening to the three of you is it's often a very small practical thing that needs to be identified and switched on or off or addressed. But it's also having faith in the people that you invest in. So thank you for what you're doing. I mean, it is genuinely life-changing. And thank you to everybody in the room for listening to them. And can I ask you to thank the panel, who've been wonderful.
A big thank you to all of our panelists for sharing their views on this important topic. If you would like to read more about our approach to promoting gender equality and the lessons we've learned from the past 6 years, you can find a link to the Closing the Gap report in the episode notes. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again soon.